Welcome, episode 41 of Crosshairs Radio. I'm not even going to, this isn't even going to be a humble brag, this is just all out brag. I'm recording this intro from the side of a mountain at the mountain bike World Cup race in Andorra. Andorra is this little principality between France and Spain, and it's amazing. It's about 70 degrees, no humidity, no insects, the sun's out, it's quiet, I'm in the woods, literally sitting on a cliffside, looking down precariously a long way, and it's beautiful. I'm out here with the Trek Factory Racing cross-country team once again, doing another slew of episodes of Trailside Dailies for that team. It's a video project I've been working on all summer. I'd love for y'all to go check it out. If you go to the Trek Factory Racing XC YouTube page, you can see all of the episodes that we've done, including we have two more that just went up for this trip to Andorra, which is the final cross-country World Cup race. While here, I got the opportunity to sit down with Simon Burney. You all probably know Simon Burney because he's the author of Cyclocross Training and Technique, which was the go-to resource for decades on cyclocross, technique. I'm sure it's a book that many of you have on your shelves. It is the book that inspired me to write Skills, Drills, and Belly Aches with Dan Tilley and do our own version of that. And we talk a little bit about the books, but Simon is also the UCI MTB coordinator. So he's very busy at these races and was gracious enough to sit down and chat for about 45 minutes. We were actually there for about an hour, but I spent 15 of that trying to get my microphones to work. Ended up recording the whole thing through this Shure Motive microphone on my phone, which is just this amazing little piece of kit. I don't know if I've talked about that before. It's what I'm recording this intro on right now. And if you ever need clear recordings, that's a secret tip. Go get one of these Motive microphones for your phone. Anyway, Shure is not sponsoring this podcast. I should probably send them an invoice. But you know who is sponsoring it is the Service Course. This service course, cyclocross, is right around the corner, and one of the most important things about having a successful cyclocross season is having a bike that works. One of the easiest ways to keep your bike working is to keep it clean, and one of the easiest ways to clean your bike is to use the brushes that are sold by Service Course. He's got a new one out there as well. There is a new cleaning brush that's been added to the quiver. You get this really nice heavy duty bucket if you buy the full kit, or you can just buy the brushes separately. But these things are great. You know, I don't like cleaning my bike. I do it so it keeps Ryan happy at Service Course. I don't want to let him down if he sees me with a dirty bike, and that's what you should be thinking about too. Think about Ryan. Think about Ryan shaking his head at your dirty bike when he walks around the course in the Mid-Atlantic and sees you, or anywhere. He could be anywhere. So what you need to go to theservicecourse.com. Go check out all of the products they have. They have some bib or even kit laundry bags, and then all of the brushes and the buckets. And follow along with Ryan as well at SC_cycling, Service Course Cycling. Go tell him that you heard about his products on Crosshairs Radio. That would be awesome. But yeah, go to theservicecourse.com and check everything out. Go buy yourself a set of brushes and make sure that your bike is clean and in working order for the upcoming season. Also, this episode brought to you by Wide Angle Podium. I believe that we are coming to the end, if not already at the end, of our pledge drive. It was supposed to be August, September. We'll say it's still going on. If you join now, I'll bet you'll still be able to get all of the Benefits of joining during the pledge drive, you know, first week of September, we should still be good. Support the shows, support Crosshairs Radio, Slow Ride Podcast, Meyerson Line, Consummate Athlete, Kids Don't Follow, Boston Bike Love, look for that one coming down the pike. They have pikes in Boston. The Honest Bicycle Program. All great podcasts. You should support them. Go to wideanglepodium.com. Become a member. It's been awesome to see all of the new members telling me that they join. You can do that too at CX Hairs on Twitter. That would really be a huge help. You know, it's starting to come along. We sounded a little dire in some of these early episodes, but this pledge drive has been a success, but there's still room to grow, and we want you to be a part of that. Finally, Skills, Drills, and Belly Aches. Book that was inspired by Simon Burney's book is out of stock right now, but in a week, I will be getting new shipments of books if you go to cyclocrossbook.com and also to Amazon and just search for Skills, Drills, and Belly Aches. Books should be back in stock next week. So if you've tried to buy it in the last week, I apologize. I am having a stern talking to my inventory manager, is me, and we're gonna make sure that we don't run out of stock of those books anymore. Finally, doing a big push for Crosshairs Media, and in the Crosshairs, we're gonna be going up to Trek Cup, and then to Cross Vegas, and then to Jingle Cross. Gonna be doing a lot of videos with that. Have a handful of photographers lined up, so we're going to be covering those fully in image text. Look to cxhairs.com. It's a really cool project, and I hope that you all follow along. Give me your feedback. Let me know what you want to see once that gets started. But that's going to be coming up soon. We got some great sponsors on board, which I will be talking to you about more in the coming weeks, but that's really exciting, and that's the next thing that we have to look forward to as we really dive into cyclocross season, which is already here. It started. We're racing. So let's get into this. Let's talk to Simon Burney and learn about a little bit about mountain bike. We talk about Peter Sagan at the end. Also some really good stuff, which I think if you are a race director, that you'll like hearing just Simon's take on UCI officials and the U.S. Strict adherence to the rules. I'll just leave it at that and let Simon explain the rest. All right, let's go talk to Simon.
All right, Simon. Thank you for your patience.
You're welcome.
So, I want to talk cyclocross, but we're at Andorra for the final World Cup mountain bike. Let's just chat about that for a second. How has the season been for you on the World Cup scene?
It's been good. It's been a good season. It's been busy, and I think the Olympics adds a new dimension to the cross-country side of the World Cup. In Olympic year, you know, you've got a lot more focus on the early rounds, people trying to qualify, and then from my point of view, trying to fit in trips to Rio to get it all figured out. During the season, it's quite difficult. There's not really a lot of time available, so it's been a challenging year till now, and then the last few weeks has been pretty crazy with... I organised a race in London the end of July, and then went straight to Montaigne Town for the World Cup, and then went home for a few days. I went back to Rio, and then it's World Cup finals, and it's downhill worlds, and then you kind of go straight to Vegas for the first cross World Cup. So busy
that's,
period.
That's when that's when the rest of us just are getting started.
Exactly.
In the cyclocross world.
But no, it's good. You know, it's
I mean, although this has been a great, you know, this is, so this will be my, I guess my fourth World Cups, first year that I'm out here covering. It's really, I've found it to be, it seems like in the last couple of years, coming closer and closer to what we see in cyclocross races, just with being able to see the race and the shorter laps and just the competitive nature of the races.
Yeah, and I think that's been a definite decision to make it, to kind of direct it in that way, really. You know, I think if you go back a couple of Olympic cycles to sort of, Beijing was probably the turning point, where the Beijing Games was a quite a long lap, and it wasn't great for television, and it wasn't a great race. And I think there was a feeling, I was just getting into the UCI stuff then, finishing with national teams and pro teams. But there was a feeling then that there was a chance that the IOC might axe it, just because it wasn't a great television and it wasn't a great Olympic spectacle, really. It was getting too expensive for them. So they, you know, there was a definite conscious decision to make the laps a bit smaller, try and make it a bit more televisual, make it a bit more exciting racing. And I think by the time we got to London, that had worked really well. And yeah, I think you're just kind of continuing that.
So making that shift over from when you're working with the national and the pro teams to this, what exactly is your position now with the UCI?
So I'm the, well, on paper, I'm the assistant mountain bike coordinator. And the assistant bit is because the actual coordinator needs to be Swiss office based. And I work as a consultant for the UCI, not as an employee, so I'm not office-based. So my colleague Annalise is officially the coordinator, but basically we kind of do the job together. And I'm on the road doing the races, and she's in the office doing all the emails and the coordinating part of it. And I kind of, you know, morphed into that role from being a technical delegate for cross-country. So I started, 2008, 2009, just being a technical delegate, just doing day rate stuff at the races, and that kind of just got gradually a bit more and a bit more involved. And so now I'm, a little bit more responsible for things like, you know, calendars and...
Yeah, but even like it seems race weekend, you're very hands-on when it comes to the actual, right now when we're setting up and then on Sunday for race day.
Yeah, I'm still responsible for the kind of the courses, more for the cross-country than the downhill. We've got two downhill technical delegates that... Because that's such a specialised thing, I kind of oversee that, but not, I'm not moving a rock or moving a post. I leave that to those guys. Mm-hmm. But cross country, I can still, do a bit of technical delegate stuff as well.
So here's a not meant to be a controversial question, but just hearing a little bit of rumblings. When you have the TV, and this has been great for TV, mm-hmm. and then you have a place like we're at today in Andorra that has amazing technical features, do you think at some point some of the technical features are left out or suffer for the TV coverage?
No, I don't think so. I think where naturally they occur, we definitely make the most of them. And where they don't occur, we build them. And I think that's where something like the London and the Rio Olympics is a case in point, where we were faced with venues that had got nothing at all about them. It's like you're looking at it and it's just a grassy, hilly park or, area. And, you want to make a race exciting and technical. You want to challenge every attribute of an athlete. So you want it to be technical. You want it to be physical. You want it to also promote close racing that's exciting for the fans and the television. So it's trying to, it's trying to get all those things together in one course. So you have to build stuff. And also for the Olympics, you can't have a situation where you've got heavy rain for the week of the race and suddenly it becomes more cyclocrossy with on and off the bike and sections on feet. So we need to make it weatherproof. It's got to be 100% rideable. So all those things combined mean that you get a situation where people looking at a course and saying, oh, it's man-made, that's not mountain biking. And the reality is that's what the very, very elite end of mountain biking has become. And it's not, that doesn't mean that every race on the calendar has to be man-made courses. Mm. We've got such a scope of events within mountain bike calendar, from the elite end of, 1 hour 25 minute, 1 hour 30 minute Olympics and World Cups and Worlds to, to regular C2 races that can be, a couple of hours long on 10K laps, and we've got marathons and we've got enduros and we've got all this other stuff. But people tend to negatively focus on man-made courses at the top end. But, that's how it's evolved. And
sure.
Yeah.
All right. So shifting gears a little bit from mountain bike to cyclocross.
Yeah,
that's,
yeah.
It's Crosshairs Radio. This is really what we are more focused on. I think most people know your name from the book that you wrote on cyclocross many years ago.
Yeah, probably.
Give us a little background just on, how you got into even cycling and then cyclocross from there.
Yeah, so I got into cycling when I was a kid, and when I was growing up, my dad was a runner. Mm. And I was into running and then got into cycling and sort of, cyclocross combined the two. So that was great for me. And I really enjoyed cyclocross and was relatively successful at it in Great Britain, which at the time wasn't a huge hotbed of
Yeah, so when you got into the scene, it must have been pretty small.
It was quite small. You know, yeah. It was always, there was always plenty of races, and that's the same now. There's still lots of races, but the elite end was quite limited. With every now and again, we'd throw out a good rider. Like we had, you know, John Atkins in the early days, and then Chris mm-hmm. Reggett, he kind of took over. And, you know, there were kind of riders that could finish, you know, top 10 in the world championships on the day and, you know, be good. And we had a handful of professional cyclocross riders in the UK, kind of early, mid-80s. And I turned professional when I was still pretty young, kind of 20, 21, and did a couple of years and rode professional world championships. And then had a big crash in a race, and that was kind of career over as far as being a cross rider. But I went straight into managing and coaching. Still quite young, I was only like mid-20s, and I was managing the guys that I was put a team together for, the guys that I was training with and racing with, you know, at the time, that were, you know, that were the best of the young cross riders from Great Britain that ended up being the kind of world mountain bike riders, you know. So
okay.
That's how I kind of got into the mountain biking, was through them, kind of late 80s, early 90s with teams. But the background was always cyclocross, yeah. And the kind of where the mountain biking's always been kind of, I felt the job, even though I love it, that's paid the bills, and cyclocross has always been the passion. So I've always managed to fit in cyclocross all through the kind of my career in cycling has always been, you know, winter time, and it always feels like a change from mountain bike to cyclocross, going from the day job almost to what I love. And then, you know, cyclocross, again, those times there wasn't any great opportunity to make money from it, so you just do what you can, really. And I just, you know, I was managing teams, and I managed the British team for World Championships. And Phil Liggett used to travel with the team as a journalist, and he'd been approached by a publishers that he'd written some books for about the Tour de France to write a cyclocross book, because they felt there was a market for it. And he's like, well, I don't really know much about cyclocross, and we were just having a beer one night, and he said, do you fancy writing it? And I was like, well, I don't know, you know. So, you know, I wrote, they just said, well, just write a sample chapter just to see if you can spell and do punctuation.
Sure.
And, you know, string words together. And yeah, just did the first one in, whatever, 89, I think.
Yeah.
And then for Springfield Publishers in the UK. And then Springfield came, mid-90s, they came under the Velo Press umbrella for distribution, and then Velo Press wanted to update it, and cyclocross was just starting to kick off in the US. And I think that was the first time, really. I did the updated version in 96, 97, something like that.
Right. The Tim Johnson cover one.
Nope.
Wasn't that? No, that was
the third one.
Oh,
the
okay.
One was the, well, depends which version you got. There was an Adrie van der Poel cover, or there was there was an Alison Dunlap cover.
Outstanding.
For the US.
Outstanding.
So, and that was the one where probably people that had getting into cross in the US suddenly had something to refer to. And I think that's probably where, you know, and I was managing some riders that were quite successful. We came, I took some riders for the first ever UCI race in the US, and they won that. And yeah, so it just kind of, that helped. And then the third version was 2000. That's the Tim Johnson version.
Yeah.
That was 2008, I think.
Oh, okay. So that's years later, right?
Yeah, yeah. So it's been pretty much every 10 years. Yeah, so yeah. I'm about to do the fourth one now. So,
yeah. Are you going to do that?
I keep thinking about it. Yeah, it's just kind of sitting down having the time
to
do it.
Can I tell you a story?
Go for it. Yeah.
I actually, when I first started in the crosshairs, I was emailing you, and we did an interview via email, and I asked you about the book. It was probably about 2009, uh-huh. And you said, well, I think maybe I've done enough editions this time for somebody else to write a book.
Exactly.
Yeah. And then that sort of sat in my head for many years, and then I went and wrote a book.
All right. Good.
So skills, drills, and belly aches. That's my version of the cyclocross
book. Good. Cyclocross book. That's great, because I always felt that somebody needed to kind of, you know, yeah, there's room for more than one, you know.
It's, sure, it's just,
a lot of it's just opinion, and
things, the people that are into it, they want as much as they can have.
And everybody can add a different ideas and different, coming from a different perspective. And mine was just a European perspective on the sport, really,
mm-hmm.
which probably at the time in the US was quite popular, because it, you know, there was a lot of interest in the sport, and you know, that whole kind of decade where cross really took off in the US.
Yeah.
You know, and there wasn't anything out there.
No,
you know,
no.
And people were desperate to just, yeah. to, you know, read anything they could find, whether it was magazines or books or whatever, you know, and I think...
And you can't, you know, there's a lot of bad YouTube videos out there showing not great technique.
Yeah, for sure, yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was a really, a real fun journey, that whole kind of watching the sport grow in the US, well, and being able to be... a little bit part of it.
It'll be interesting. I hope you do pursue that. It'd be cool to see another edition out there.
Yeah.
Speaking of cyclocross, what is your official position now in the sport of cyclocross?
I guess I'm just a fan now, you know. I've never really had full-on UCI involvement in it. Mm-hmm. So every now and again, I'll be a technical delegate for a World Cup if you know, somebody's on holiday or somebody's sick or whatever, and they always know that they can call me up and I'll do it. But I'm not the cyclocross guy at the UCI. So it's really now, you know, even forever really, since I stopped managing teams, I've just been at races, been involved, helped out when I can, organised the World Cup in the UK. You know, as an example, like Brooke asks me if I'll, you know,
sure.
to help him out for Vegas,
and I'll we'll see you there in a couple of weeks.
Gladly go and help him, and you know, that's it really. I haven't really got a role as such.
So being involved in the sport for so long, and we sort of touched on mountain biking and how that's evolved over the years.
Yeah.
How do you think that, you know, what do you think are the biggest changes from say the 80s until now in cyclocross, and do you look back on that time and think that anything may have been better then than the sport that we see today?
You don't really realize what's changed until you go watch a video of an old race. And even you go back to, you know, 2005 and you look at a race and you think, oh, that looks, you know, looks terrible, or the course marking's bad, or it's a crappy course design or whatever. So you don't really realize, because things just evolve
right.
quite slowly.
Well, you got even like, you know, world championships where course tape was sort of optional.
Absolutely.
There's just fans Absolutely. All on
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Yeah. And that's, you know, and I think probably courses and the television obviously has made a big difference, but you know, the courses, you don't really get those, you know, the bigger, harder, epic, muddy, hilly races that you used to have, you know, in the 80s, where you can look at a video of, you know, whatever race it was and you know, world championships in wherever, Hagendorf or Vetsikon or something. And it's a, you know, you think, whoa, that's full on, you know, that's probably missing. It's probably got a little bit more clinic and a little bit cleaner and a little bit, you know, a little bit neater for television.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not a bad thing. It's, you know, it's more of a television product. Again, we're talking at the top end.
Sure,
really, you know?
Of course, yeah.
And I think the other thing that's changed is with the increase in popularity and the mass participation, which is mirrored in the US and the UK, where people don't necessarily like the lots of running in races and they like to ride the bikes more. And I think that's changed. You know, I think we find in the UK where if there is a race where, whatever reason, the weather's bad or the course is very hilly, that there's a lot of running, the participation is always lower than a race if it's
despite everybody's friends shaming them into that. This is, I always love the phrase, this is real cyclocross weather.
Yeah.
It's like, well, if you live in Florida, it's not real cyclocross weather, and you still race cyclocross there. It's an environmental sport. You gotta race with what's around you.
I mean, in the US especially, I mean, you've got such varied climates in
mm-hmm.
all these pockets where it's popular that you can't really compare to the next. It's very difficult.
You know, a struggle that I think a lot of fans have, interested on your take on this, is the participatory versus the pro sport. So for us in the US, you know, we have an ocean in between. You know, the sport is one thing. We need courses that everybody can ride, and nobody's paying to go watch a race. And then everybody sees on TV, through whatever means they need to see it, the Belgian races that are, you know, it's only the pros ride.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's sort of the struggle where, well, we want to be more like Belgium. That's always it. And then my take is always, we have the best of both worlds.
Absolutely.
Because
we
can go out and race our races, and then we can go home and watch, you know, the Belgium. Superheroes do it.
Exactly. And I think that's the difference. It's the fact that the Belgium courses are there for 40 riders only. They're not there for a weekend of 12 racers from everybody from under 14s to over 70s. And you have to have an amount of dumbing down of courses to be able to cater for everybody with safely, give them a good experience, give them something to race on. And the elite race within that weekend is a small part of it, and that's not what's paying the bill for the organizer. That's the kind of the icing on the cake. But and I think there's probably ways to have, you know, pro lines on courses where or, you know, very slight changes in courses that mean that the elite are racing and challenged a little bit more maybe than, you know, with a big run up or something that maybe the Masters 50 plus race probably isn't suited to, you know, or you know, big descents and things that you see in Belgium, and that's right. The things that people comment on. Yeah.
Do you think the courses and the skills of the riders have gotten to the point that the courses now need to be even more technical? For instance, you know, I know a long time ago people were able to ride barriers, and then it went away, and then it became this novelty if somebody can just hop over. Now it seems like at the top level, it's a necessary skill. You know, if you're dismounting, you're losing time, especially just on. So do we need to then, or do there? Is that good for it, or do the courses even need to be harder at that top level?
And I think things like barrier hopping, it's all about where you put barriers and why you have barriers in. What are you trying to do with barriers? You know, if everyone's hopping barriers, honestly, there's not a real need to have them there because it's not really affecting the race if the top 20 guys can do it. If you've got a barrier or a set of barriers before a steep bank or before a camber or something that means that it's actually beneficial to jump off of the barriers, jump the barriers, run the next section, that's the reason to put barriers in, because without that maybe you'd ride the bank. So right. You know, you can make a run-up out of something that wouldn't necessarily be a run-up. You know, barriers, you know, I think again it depends on what else is on the course. If a course is, or the venue you've got is quite bland and boring, and you need something just to liven it up a little bit, stick some barriers in. But if you've got plenty going on, don't put barriers in just for the sake of putting barriers in, you know, because there's no real, in my opinion, again, there's no real need.
We have a, just sort of all over the map here, but just things I want to get your opinion on. A lot of times as race directors, we will have our UCI officials who will, in the U.S., who are going to hold us to every letter of the law.
Yeah.
So our courses are going to be, there's not going to be a 180 turn. Everything's going to be 3 meters. You know, if it's in the book, we have to do it.
Yeah.
We turn on TV and are pulling our hair out. I was like, why are they allowed to do that? Why are they allowed to do that?
It's very hard for me to say anything without sounding critical of the officials, but it seems to be a mentality of the US officials that they want to work like that, and they're not looking at the reason behind the regulation or the kind of the principle behind it. They're looking at the letter of it, and that's, I have it with the mountain bike commissaires as well, that, you know, be flexible, be, you know, think about what the rider's doing, why the rule's there, but just use some common sense. And it is frustrating. I can do the same. I can watch a race somewhere and see that a commissaire is being particularly pedantic about a rule, and it's like, well, just lighten up a little bit, you know? You're there to be a referee for the race and to make sure the race is fair,
right,
and use that as your guiding example. We don't want people cheating. That's why referees are there. We don't want that. But, you know, if a venue can only do something with a 180 degree turn 50 meters after the start, go for it. As long as it's, you know, relatively safe, it's fine. You know, it's not a big deal. And yeah, it just seems to be a bit of a US official mentality thing.
What in your view do you think the problem with grabbing and swinging around posts caused, and why do you think that rule had to be changed? Or we have our triangles now at 180 turns.
Again, you know, I kind of get it, but I think that's a skill in itself.
Yeah.
As long as the poles are in, you know, in the ground properly. I think when things, you know, again, after a number of races or a number of laps and training where things start to move and you know, there's a chance that a pole's going to come out and cause a catalogue of disasters with tape falling over and fencing. Yeah, I can understand it. But again, it has its place, I still think, you know.
My theory was, and I think that what I heard was it was even some rider complaints that caused them to look at this. Uh-huh. My theory is that bikes have gotten so light now. It was guys like, not to pick on him, but Gianni Vermeersch, who was like, had his, almost as a discus, his bike swinging around while he's grabbing that pole.
Okay. Yeah.
And maybe that was caught, yeah, beyond what they wanted, the expectation of the rule.
Yeah,
but it
maybe.
Is something that was always fun to watch.
It was
those
fun.
Guys
yeah,
being
yeah,
able
yeah,
to fling
sure.
themselves, and even, you know, when it was, what, Stibar and Sven a couple years ago in the World Championship, mm-hmm. and Sven missed the post, and it pretty much,
yep.
you know, was
yep.
the race right there. So
yep.
that was a hugely exciting
Absolutely.
Thing. So,
yeah.
You
touched on bikes then. I think that's something that's changed. I think has changed the sport significantly. I think since that, you know, if we go back to, you know, whatever the glory days were, a cyclocross, you know, the 80s or something, 70s, that, you know, bike technology's come on so much that's definitely made a difference to the technical ability of the riders. You know, that's added an immense amount. Whether it's, you know, going from 26mm tyres to 33mm tyres, or better braking, or more efficient gearing, or bigger range of gears, these kind mm-hmm. of things, they've all had an impact on the racing. So I think that's a, you know,
what do you think about that? Because there are a lot of purists out there that still just get rankled with cantilever brakes. What do you think about the move to disc brakes?
Oh, it's fine. You know, it's just progression. It's just it's like saying, well, we should all be using bar end shifters. It's no different.
And I know some people who are agreeing with you right now that we all should be.
Yeah, and tape lips and everything else. You know, it's that's the way it is. You know, just embrace technology and you find. You use the best technology, or use the technology that's the best for the circumstance you find yourself in. And honestly, maybe a cable accentuated disc isn't the best thing. You know, it's heavier and it probably doesn't work as well. Or, you know, disc pads wear out in certain parts of the country because the soil's gritty or whatever. You know, and you don't have to use anything. You can use what the hell you want. And, you know, you use what's best to get you around the race in the fastest way possible, really. And I think just go with it, you know.
Yeah, and now we get these situations like with Matthew Vanderpool, where he's able to sort of drift himself into, like, you know, two riders on there, just couldn't do that without disc brakes.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
So
I think the difficulty is when you've probably got a garage full of, you know, of wheels that, you know, and suddenly it is a big step to change, and I think
And that's always the criticism, that it's something that the bike industry is pushing on everyone so that they can, you know, keep selling bikes, keep selling wheels,
well,
and that kind of
stuff.
I think
the bike industry just are continually trying to develop anyway, and I think I think, you know, it's your responsibility to decide what you want to use and how much money you want to spend, and you do
right
what's good for your circumstances, don't you? You know?
We're starting at the World Cup and on the pro cross-country mountain bike scene, starting to see a lot more dropper posts. Do you ever think mm-hmm. that'll technology will make its way over to cyclocross?
I'm sure it will, in some form or another. Yeah, you know, I think if courses, you know, if there's a certain course where that's an advantage, why wouldn't you put one on? Absolutely. You know, it's an easy thing to change. You can have a saddle on one, you can drop it in for training, do a lap with it, see if it works. If it does, leave it on. If it doesn't, you take it off and save a few grams, you know. But yeah, I mean, dropper posts is probably the next thing that's come out in the last you know, couple of years on the mountain bike that will, I'm sure it'll make its way across at some point. Yeah.
With this is with the top level of cyclocross, especially with European cyclocross, what do you see as some things that they still need to improve on? For instance, you know, for the U.S., because I think it's one of the things that we do well is giving equal payouts, men and women, and it seems like European races, especially Belgium, are starting still. To embrace that a little bit, you know, and even have women series in the, you know, super prestige and that where that counts. It's just not a race and they're no longer at 7:30 in the morning and all that. Yeah. That seems like the biggest for me. Is that, I mean, you can talk about that if you want, but is there anything else that you think needs to be done that could give the sport a more universal appeal or even just make the sport healthier?
It's difficult because Belgium feel like they've got it nailed. That's the market, and that's all they care about. Honestly, they don't really care too much if the sport grows in the UK or Southern Italy or Luxembourg. You know, all they care about is their TV audience and their star riders. And all the sponsors for all the teams are all linked to the television, which is going out, you know, live twice a weekend. And that's all they care about. And, you know, the harsh reality is that they think that the women don't attract the same TV audience and the same media numbers that the guys do, so they pay them less. You know, it's really, really hard for a woman to get a worthwhile salary compared to a guy. That's the market force that's driving it. And it's not about, absolutely women should be equal to men. Absolutely. You know, there's no doubt in today's society that's the way it should be, but it's still driven by by the money that's there.
I think you're absolutely right, and one of the things, and I may be wrong on this, is that what we saw last year is that the women's ratings were pretty good.
They
were getting 500,000-600,000 viewers leading into the men's races. Mm-hmm. So really, hopefully last year showed sponsors that this really isn't a gamble to bet on women.
Absolutely, but then you still have a situation where the biggest team out there, you know, Sven's team, is, well, I'll wait to see what's actually going to happen, but, you know, they're dropping the women's part of the team. Reducing it.
Yeah.
You know, and that's not a good message to send out to the other teams, because it was started, Telenet Fedea probably started the first one hiring women onto a very, very Belgian team. And that was a bit of a catalyst for the other teams to do it. And if they don't continue that, you know, the other teams will say, well, you know, why do we need to, you know, stick a couple of women on there? And it's not just like a token gesture. That's the important thing. It's okay to stick a couple of women on there and give them bikes and give them a few euros as, you know, as petrol money. But it's the whole different thing to actually having it sustainable circuit for the women to be able to, you know, make a living on and race professionally.
Yeah, I think Helen Wyman's actually done a really good job in sort of bringing some of that to the forefront. And
she is, and she's, you know, she's very vocal about it, and she's a very, very good ambassador for women cycling. And she, you know, she gives the Cyclocross Commission at the UCI a real hard time about why they aren't progressing the changes faster. And that's, you know, she's the kind of the pain in the ass that the UCI need, because you know, they need to, you know, to make some changes, and she was the catalyst to kind of make some of those happen. And it's not happening as fast as she'd like it to happen, but it's coming. You need to go back to how the men's circuit got into that situation, and it was all about start money. And the World Cup came along and was paying start money, and then that's a bad model, in my opinion. The UCI changed it and put the start money into the prize money. So you got this huge amount of prize money in UCI Cyclocross World Cup level, which is way out of kilter with mountain biking or BMX or any other UCI sport. And it's out of sync with the women's side, because the women at the time weren't getting the start money. So To raise the women's to the same level as men's is taking it way into the financial league of not being sustainable for organisers and for the UCI.
Right.
What needs to happen is the guys need to take a step back and to realise that it's for the best of the sport as a whole to get less money. They're still making good money from the sponsors and the teams and from the start money they get for the whatever, you know, super prestigious and BPOS and everything else. You know, it's just this World Cup that's not aligned.
So basically what needs to happen is that the sport needs to gain, it can't be as Belgian centric in its appeal. I mean, that's the heart of it. You know, I always joke that it's the, you know, biggest local series in the world,
yeah,
you know,
exactly,
with all the best riders. They're not they don't have to travel, they don't, you know, and they're right there. So I think it needs that same level of popularity and sponsorship, which doesn't exist anywhere in other parts of the world, for them to sort of have some competition. Because right now they sort of can do what they want, right? I mean, they get a little pressure, and they've changed, but
but you know, it's only things like the UCI having a rule for how many rounds you can have in a series. You know, that's a maximum of 8, but we've still got 4 series going on. In, you know, there's the World Cup, you've got your Super Prestige, you've got the one that was the B Post,
right,
now the new one.
Yes.
You've got the FIDEA Cup. You've got so much stuff going on. There isn't a spare weekend.
Right.
And you've got series like, I really admire the guys in Switzerland that have done this.
The EKZ is great.
Series.
Yeah.
I think they're doing a really good job. They're trying to get Swiss Cross back to how it was when the Swiss were the best at it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're trying really hard. And I think it's really difficult when the calendar is saturated with Belgian events, to be able to have a weekend where the best guys from Belgium actually go to Switzerland and do a race.
Right.
So that, you know, those Swiss organisers, and whether it's a Swiss or the French Cup or National Trophy in the UK or, you know, a US race, it's, you're trying to find a weekend, you're trying to find a slot where you can get 2 or 3 names that will then help your sponsors, give you a bit of TV time, and just kind of perpetuate the,
right,
the media.
Yeah, you know, for a second there, I thought like Francis Moret had retired, but he'd
gone to Switzerland.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And fair play to him, you know, he was getting pretty good money doing the Belgian races,
mm-hmm,
and he, you know, he stepped away from those on purpose, still does some of the World Cups, stepped away from the Belgian circuit because he felt he was getting, he wasn't getting the respect he deserved where his ability level lay with, compared with the Belgians, and went and did the Swiss ones and the French ones and a toy cup in Czech Republic,
right,
or whatever,
right,
else he can do. So, yeah.
Get the question a lot, and maybe you have a perspective about this since you're not from the U.S., about what it would take for a U.S. rider to actually succeed in European cyclocross. You know, is it the Jonathan Page model, or is it possible to almost like commute as everyone is trying to do now?
I think people underestimate the effect that transatlantic commuting has on you. You know, I've done it a lot over the years, mainly for mountain bike, and you know, I've coached a lot of riders that go backwards and forwards, and it's really, really difficult. You lose so much training time and recovery time. You know, travel days aren't recovery days. They're a stress in themselves. And I think the only way to do it is to, you've either got to go once or twice a winter to Europe and stay there for a few weeks and kind of pick your blocks. You know, maybe go over in, you know, October and do 6 weeks and do a load of races, go home, recover, and then go back again for the January time. You know, whether it's Christmas races or you kind of stay home for national champs and just go for the last 2 World Cups and Worlds, or you just do the kind of the, you know, the Page model and just go for the season,
mm-hmm,
and don't try and replicate your US life
right
in the middle of Belgium,
right,
because that's where it falls apart. You know, you can't get Mexican food and get a nice coffee and have all those hours of daylight in the middle of Flanders in
sunshine
in December. You know, you can't do it. It's not Colorado, you know.
Right.
And
right.
It's a really hard thing to get your head around.
Right.
And, you know, I kind of, as an outsider or as a fan, you know, I kind of watch Jeremy Powers, kind of what he's trying to do, and kind of feel that it's not the right, it's really difficult for him to do it and succeed. And so far, he's always struggled later in the season when it's really mattered. You know, he can come out firing at Vegas and he can do great in October, and he can come to the first World Cup and he can, you know, the weather's still good and the courses are still fast and he's great. He's as good as anybody in the world. And if he could continue that for longer without trying to, you know, just kind of build this little America in the middle of Belgium, mm-hmm, and, you know, I think it is difficult. And I think, you know, like Elle Anderson has gone back, you know, this year to try and do it.
She's like already left.
Yeah, exactly. She's there now. And it's, and you know, she's kind of doing the kind of the program that Amy Dombrowski was trying to do, you know, or did for a couple of years.
Right.
You know, it's that kind of, you go, you immerse yourself in it, you try and learn a bit of the language, you know, you make friends with Belgians, you eat their food, you live in their houses, and you just go with it.
Right.
And but it's a very, very, it needs a very certain mindset to be able to adapt to it and to accept it and to be able to function in it and to be able to compete, you know, as well as somebody who's that's their home. That's right. What they've grown up with. And it's a very different scenario. And some people thrive with it. Some people, it's exciting and it's different and it's, stimulating. And some people just spend the whole time looking for the sunshine and looking for a Mexican Mexican restaurant and realizing that actually they don't want to be there. They want to be back in,
Yeah, and I think California. Even like Katie Compton has it, where she has that infrastructure there. She has a family. Yeah. She knows where everything is.
She knows the training road. She knows where she can train. She's got it all figured out. And I think, you know, Katie's, tried for a lot of years, but I think Katie's had a lot of other challenges along the way.
Yeah, I think this year, I have a feeling. Seeing her on the road, she was crushing these crit races and showing up. She's got a lot to prove this year.
Yeah,
so it's going to be interesting to see.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, she's not getting any younger.
No.
And it's every year it's going to get harder because, you know, the level of women's racing is always is still improving. So, yeah, that's going to be an interesting
All right, thing. So another sort of outside looking in view, the United States has 40 plus UCI cyclocross races this year.
Yeah.
Is that too many?
Well, it's a big country.
It is.
I think it's the kind of the, how can I describe it? Since the US Grand Prix went away, that the having a structured calendar of big events where all the big names are together not every weekend, but at certain events seems to have gone away. And I think that's if that stays like that for too long, it'll have an adverse effect because there's too many little pockets. It's such a huge country, and you've got these pockets where it's cross is very, very popular, but the people aren't really, there's no cross fertilization of riders and ideas and you know. So everyone comes together at national championships, but by then it's a little bit too late for the kind of the season goals and the world championships and things. So I think if they can streamline the UCI races a little bit, try and get, you know, another 8-race series like the USGP was, whether it's just 4 venues of 2 a weekend or whether it's, you know, a little bit more weekends, but where all the Americans want to be. That's where, you know, they'll come back from Europe if they have to go do those races.
Right.
I think the USGP did a really impressive job in growing the sport.
Yep.
And I understand why it went away, but you know, I think it's almost time now for somebody else to step up.
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting. I mean, one, you know, the biggest obvious challenge with that, of course, is finding a sponsor that mm-hmm. wants to bankroll that. The other interesting part of it is now these C1 races have gotten this autonomy and all of the individual organizers have been able to run their races, so getting them all sort of on the same page to have one person or one entity running all those races maybe.
Yeah.
But I like the idea instead of just 8 separate weekends of just having 4. I think that's probably
what USGP did.
Right.
They had a C1 on day 1 and a C2 on day 2. Changed the course a little bit between the two, and it worked really well. And I think it's just even if it's the US Federation events department, just targeting races that make sense from a travel point of view.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, not one weekend you're on the West Coast and then you're back, whatever, West Coast,
sure,
whoever else it is. Just streamlining it a little bit. I'm pretty sure there's some UCI races there what I can't understand is how there's so many UCI cyclocross races and there's zero UCI mountain bike races.
It makes
no sense. Everybody wants to be the UCI cross organizer, but they don't want to be the UCI mountain bike organizer.
Mountain bike's in an interesting place right now in the US.
I'd like
to see that third resurgence of mountain bike in the US. We'll see where that goes. So looking forward, you know, we got you're going to be in Vegas, we got that coming up, and then the whole, you know, docket of UCI and professional level races. Who are you looking? Let's start with the women. Who do you think is going to be on top of the women this year, or who do you think is going to be a dark horse?
Well, that's difficult. I mean, we've got a new world champion.
Yeah.
So it's going to be interesting to see how she...
Are we going to see her?
Well, hopefully, you know. I think that's going to be the interesting thing at Vegas. Yeah. I think he's going to see who... Well, with Vegas and then Iowa 3 days later, who shows up, first of all, who's competitive, who starts the World Cup with success that means they'll continue on for the rest of the season. Because, you know, two races is a lot different just to having Vegas. You know, if you missed Vegas last year, and some people did, then you could still, by the end of the season, you could still get yourself in there. If you miss the first two World Cups, you're kind of putting yourself on the back foot for good gridding and good kind of, you know, performance moving forward. So that'll be interesting. But I think, yeah, hopefully we've got the world champions at the well, I'm pretty sure we'll have the men's, but whether,
yep,
hopefully we'll get the women's as well. I think the women's racing, I think the last couple of seasons, it's been way more exciting than the men's.
I agree.
I'd rather watch a women's race than a men's race. And it's the same in mountain biking as well. Yeah. Same thing. You know?
Well, you have a group at the end. You have it's dynamic, and there's strategy going into those last couple laps. At the men, it's pretty much, you know, two guys and maybe...
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a third or fourth who can hang on.
And the third one's probably retired now as well. So
yeah, that's exactly.
But yeah, it's like, you know, Rio last week, we went into the women's race and there are probably 8 or 10 women that could have got on the podium.
Yeah.
And that's a great scenario to have because, you know, I could run out a load of names now for the season, but it wouldn't, I think it's a good situation to be in, you know.
Here's a Rio question for you, and one I'm sure you've gotten a lot of. Sagan being there, good, bad, distraction, fun to see.
Great, awesome. I loved having him there, you know, and I could, just watching him training and watching him trying to figure it out in a very short space of time, I kind of realised after the first day of training, I think that the chances are he was going to puncture if he didn't snap a chain. I watched him doing start practice and snap chain. I saw him puncturing in the race, and he was just—he's so fast, and he's so strong, and he's his level is so good, but he's just way too fast for his intricate technical ability on a course like that. You know, it's a lot of rock gardens and a lot of drops. He was hitting stuff faster than he'd got experience of, and he's trying to follow the guys that do it week in, week out. And I think if he'd have just done a race, you know, just one race 2 or 3 weeks before it with those guys. Right. Just to understand how fast they go on a technical course and how fast these technical sections you come to them and how fast you go through them, I think it would have made a big difference. I think physically you can't fault him.
Sure.
Technically, generally you can't. It's just that extra 2%.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of putting it, that he was basically too fast for his own skill level.
And I think that's all it was. Yeah. And the other thing that happened was it rained during the night of between the women's race and the men's race. So the guys were running the tyres slightly softer to get a little bit of traction. And, yeah, just that those little bit softer meant that there were a lot more punctures on Sunday with people trying a little bit too hard. And the Olympics, everybody's going way into the red. They're trying way harder. They're all going, you know, faster than they've ever been before. And it's...
What I thought was great about it, too, was, you know, just following Twitter while I'm watching the race. And there are more guys I know, you know, at every level who are... road racers who have no interest in mountain bike at all,
but watching
who were watching it just for him, and then a lot of them stuck with it because they saw that it's exciting racing. Yeah, it's fun to watch. So.
Yeah. And I think, you know, just the extra media that he brought to the event was great. But I think just I've got huge respect for him packing up, you know, not going to the road race and just wanting to be part of the mountain bike race. I think that says a lot about him as a character, you know.
But do you think after he saw that Greg Van Amerit won that he wasn't kicking himself a little bit?
Maybe.
Awesome. Yeah. All right. Well, I think that's pretty much all I have. I want to thank you again for sitting down and chatting with me, especially a busy time for you in this last World Cup. You're going to be excited to have at least your duties with the UCI mountain bike world over after this weekend.
We're just downhill world championships next week. It's that switch between the last mountain bike race and going to Vegas for the first one. I'm excited to go to Vegas and start that season as well.
Great. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.